Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
12 voices in 12 hours. This is a special community discussion on opioid prevention on News Radio 930 WBEN.
Good morning. WBEN News Time is 7:05, and our day-long conversation on the opioid crisis is underway this morning. Dr. Richard Blondell is joining us in studio. He's with the University of Buffalo, a leader in the field of addiction medicine. And let's just start by getting your perspective on this. Where are we in this crisis? Are we starting to get a handle on it?
I think the crisis has been getting worse. It's not getting as bad as quickly, but I don't think we've turned the corner on this at all.
You know, we hear a lot of these numbers in Erie County, how deaths have decreased. Do you look at that as a good indication of where we are, or are there just so many more numbers to keep in mind when thinking about how many people are addicted to opioids?
Well, deaths due to opioid overdose is just one thing that you can look at. You also have to look at how many people overdosed, received Narcan, and didn't die. So there's still a lot of people who are overdosing. They just don't show up as deaths because we're doing a little bit better job of pulling them back from the fire.
Well, is Narcan offering false security here, or what do you see Narcan's role in this?
I don't think Narcan offers false security. I don't think anybody goes out and intentionally overdoses knowing that there's Narcan right nearby to pull them back. That's the big concern. And maybe there's a case or two like that, but is that a common situation? That's not what I see.
When the discussion maybe goes back about 5 years or so, when this started kind of really getting in the people's minds, conscious that there is a problem here in Western New York and really across the country. In those 5 years, you mentioned that we've made some progress, that it's not getting as bad
as quickly.
You say that, and it kind of, I think, maybe catches people off guard because they've been hearing some good things, hearing, you know, about a lot of these measures that have been put in place. We just talked about prescribing practices with doctors, how it's a little bit different. We're still getting bad, though. Why do you think that is?
Because we really haven't reversed the prescriptions. We've sort of halted the increase, but we are still overprescribing. We still prescribe four times the amount of opioids that we did, say, 15 years ago. You're right. We became really aware of this situation 5 years ago, but it was happening 15 years before that. So this has been going on since about 1990. So it's just caught the public's attention recently, but it's been there for a long time, and it's a long time coming. Only since there's been so many more overdose deaths, particularly among the children of people who have influence in our society, have we become really aware of this. But I'm here to tell you, I practiced in Kentucky from 1985 to 2003. And I can tell you it began there in the late 1980s. And it has spread across the country and has grown worse nationwide. We have sort of limited the rise of the number of prescriptions, which fuels this epidemic. So they have leveled off, but they are nowhere near the levels of prescriptions that we were writing in the late 1980s.
So where do we have to take this next? I mean, where do we move from here?
We've been through this before. We've been through an opioid epidemic before at the beginning of the 20th century. We know how to fix this epidemic. We know what we need to do. It's just hard to do it.
Hard to do it. You mentioned kind of a leveling off of those prescriptions, but we're nowhere near where we were. And there's a lot of people who take these prescription medications who think, you know, there's nothing else that can work for me. What was working in the past before you mentioned that this this proliferation of opioids?
Well, I started practice 40 years ago this coming July. And in the late 1970s, if I had written a prescription for a month's worth of opioids for any reason, I would have got a call from the pharmacist asking me, you know, what was I doing? And I remember distinctly, I mean, I maybe wrote for 4 or 5 prescriptions for opioids per year. And that it was usually for like 3 to 5 days for a sprained ankle or broken bone or whatever. But I do remember one time I wrote for a month's worth, 120 tablets of an opioid, a low-dose opioid, for a woman who had end-stage breast cancer. Had was all over her body, and she was suffering in pain. She was near death. And I remember getting a call from the pharmacy questioning what I was doing. And I said, well, this lady probably doesn't have long to live. She's in the end stages of breast cancer. He said, oh, okay. We'll just need to write that on the prescription. So that was the level of suspicion we had back then. Now, some 16-year-old goes to the dentist, gets a wisdom tooth out, gets 60 tablets of Lortab, no questions asked. No good can come from that. So we need to get back to where we were 20 years ago. Now, at that time, doctors were accused of undertreating pain, that we were being cruel, that we were withholding medication from people out of a fear that we might make people addicted. And we probably did undertreat cancer pain and people were dying. And we maybe didn't treat post-operative pain as aggressively as we should have. But that's it. Nobody needs 60 tablets of Lortab after wisdom tooth. I can tell you that right now. Nobody.
In studio with Dr. Richard Blondell, you were mentioning kind of this the prescribing practices when it comes to opioids throughout the last few decades, how it's grown. And right before we took a quick break there, you mentioned going to the dentist. And, you know, it's one of those things that I think kind of perks the ears of a lot of people who are of that age, the wisdom tooth age. They're in high school, and then they start to get these prescriptions for pills that they soon realize are maybe in demand with some of their peers. Kids knew this before doctors did, it seems. How is that possible?
You know, you mentioned that adolescents knew this before the doctors. You know, there's one thing that comes with a youthful mind, and they have often great perception, and they can see through things that others can't, because oftentimes their vision is not clouded by a lot of preconceptions. So they're very astute, and anybody who's had a teenager knows that if you try to pull the wool over their eyes, they're pretty good at like calling you out on it. So they sort of know what's going on. I think the medical community sort of lived in this Pollyannish type world that, you know, everything was going to be fine, and we kept telling ourselves that everything was fine. Only when it became really obvious did we sort of wake up to the fact that things weren't fine.
But, you know, do you see, though, that today it seems like dentists especially are not prescribing that much of an opioid for wisdom teeth to come out? Some doctors won't write any. They've decided not to do this at all anymore. Have we swung maybe too far the other side?
Absolutely not. There are some physicians or dentists that have maybe swung too far and have overreacted to this and have not just limited their prescriptions to appropriate levels. But we are still way over prescribing. I mean, Americans consume 90 to 95% of the hydrocodone on the planet. We just don't have 90 to 95% of the pain out there. We just don't. I was given a talk once, and a man came up to me, and I was telling about my concern with people who became addicted. And so he came up to me at the end of the talk and asked, he had a little cyst on his neck, a little tiny thing, and he was concerned about being addicted. He wanted to know what opioid he could take following the surgery that was less addictive. And I told him, you don't need anything. And he said, well, what if it hurts? And I said, well, just, it's going to hurt a little bit. You know, you just have to tough this out. 40 years ago, when I went into practice, a lot of my patients were the World War II generation. They were tough cookies, and they could tolerate a lot of pain. And in fact, they would refuse narcotics because they thought it was a sign of weakness. And to put them on morphine was like, in their mind, I'm going to die. So they wanted to stay off morphine as long as possible because they thought that was thrown in the towel and they were going to die. They didn't want this stuff. Now, one of the things that's fueling this epidemic is patient demand. And there's this perception out there that we're going to live in an entirely pain-free world and that we're going to be in this perpetual state of euphoria and everything's going to be fine and feel good and so forth. It's not like that.
Well, I'd imagine it's easy to kind of then slip into from that World War II patient mentality like you spoke of to, hey, you know, we can make this easier on you. You know, not a lot of people are going to say no to that, but coming the opposite way now is where you're going to see some friction.
Well, you want to look at risk benefits, you know. Well, what is the benefit of really snowing people with pain meds after wisdom tooth versus what's the risk? We know that if someone under the age of 17 gets one prescription, just one prescription for an opioid, even if it's a limited amount, like 5 days, one prescription, after the age of 23, they're going to have a 33% increased chance of developing an addiction. So you have to look at what's the benefit to that adolescent from 5 days of opiates for a little ankle sprain versus what's the risk. If I was a parent and I had a 16-year-old and I understood that risk and there was a little ankle sprain, I'd say to my kid, here's some ice, put your ankle up, here's some aspirin, tough it out, because I don't think it's worth the risk. Now, if somebody had major surgery or big broken bone, you know, that's another story. But we're treating minor pain now with very potent drugs, and it's totally inappropriate.
Dr. Blundell, are you saying that if you have opiates for wisdom teeth when you're a teenager, that will still impact you if you're 30 years old?
Absolutely. We know this. In fact, we did a little study at ECMC, and we went up there to the detox unit from people in middle age, and we asked them, how did your addiction start? About 40% of them started. Their addiction started with their very own prescription for a pain meds that was given for a legitimate purpose. Half of them for a wisdom tooth. So 20% of the people at ECMC on the detox unit started their addiction with a prescription for a wisdom tooth. So the question is that worth the risk? Now, when I was an intern, I had a wisdom tooth problem. And I didn't have much money. So I was at the VA hospital, and one of my dentist friends was willing to pull them out for me. So I made hospital rounds. My lunch hour, went up there, got two wisdom teeth out, got some gauze in my mouth, went back to the hospital, finished the rest of the day. You know, they hurt a little bit, but it wasn't that bad. I didn't need to go home for a week and get snowed on Lortab. So here's the things that's driving this epidemic. Number one, we have these potent drugs that are promoted by the pharmaceutical companies. Number two, we have doctors who now have been taught, like, prescribe this stuff because it's safe. Go at it, man. We've got number three, patient demand. We got number four, the insurance companies pay for all this stuff. So in some ways, the insurance company dollars has subsidized this epidemic. And number five, the pharmacies have really not had the same level of surveillance around these prescriptions as they did, say, 40 years ago. So they've backed off. And those five things have really all come together to contribute to making this epidemic. Now, to fix this epidemic, we have to, like, reverse all that.
12 Voices in 12 Hours continues on WBEN, and our in-studio guest this hour is Dr. Richard Blundell. And we've been talking about some of the things, especially prescribing practices over the last couple of decades that have resulted in where we are right now. And the things you've been talking about, sprained ankles, wisdom teeth coming out, you know, being prescribed these opiate pain medications, something that I think a lot of people can relate to. It's normal, everyday practices that result in an addiction that can lead to something like a heroin problem. I think people, though, still have the perception when they hear about heroin or hear about being addicted to opioids of street drugs, of crack cocaine from the 80s, of things like that, without realizing exactly who this epidemic is impacting. And it's happening all over and happening in streets where you might not recognize that there's drug problems going on.
Well, that's right. I mean, this epidemic of opioids, unlike the crack cocaine epidemic, really is fueled by the legitimate prescription industry rather than the illegitimate prescription industry. So this epidemic started with legitimate prescribed medications. I think the doctors had good intentions, and the thought was that we were undertreating pain and we needed to do a better job. We were told these medications were safe and non-addictive. Turned out that was not the case. So we've learned the hard way. As I mentioned, we've been through this before. We went through an epidemic of prescription opioids in the early 20th century when these were widely available. You could get heroin without a prescription. Just go down to your corner drugstore. And doctors had hypodermic needles and were injecting people. So there was another epidemic similar to this at the beginning of the 20th century. We sort of have forgotten the lessons that we learned, and we repeated the same mistakes in the last part of the 20th century, unfortunately, and we're now paying the consequences. But having said that, because we've been through this before, and we sort of know how to fix epidemics, we have the knowledge and the tools to do damage control, to sort of try to repair the damage of the people who are addicted now. But the other big thing that we really need to do is prevention. And it is much, much, much easier to prevent somebody from being addicted in the first place than it is to try to treat them and reverse the course once they're addicted. So when we've dealt with any kind of epidemic, whether it's polio or infectious diseases or whatever, the answer has always been prevention. Treatment is sort of like when prevention has failed. So we need to have treatment to pick up the pieces of the mess that we made. But what we really, really need to do is to have a solid strategy of prevention so that we don't continue to prescribe people into addiction. So we need to go back to a little bit about how medicine was practiced in the 1980s, when the use of prescription opioid medications was very judicious, and pharmacists and patients and doctors were well aware of what the risks were from these highly potent addictive medications. And we treated them with respect, and we used them carefully. In much the same way that fire is good, it cooks our food and heats our houses, but we don't want to set our house on fire either. So we have safety measures in place to use fire safely and appropriately so it could do some of the good things we wanted to do and not do some of the bad things like burn us or burn our house down. So analogous to this is our use of opiates. We need to be smart. We need to understand how potent they are. And we need to prescribe a lot less.
12 voices in 12 hours. This is a special community discussion on opioid prevention on News Radio 930 WBEN.
12 voices in 12 hours continues on WBEN with Dr. Richard Blondell joining us live in studio, talking about a lot of things, and including prevention, which I know is one of the things you wanted to touch on when talking about how to reverse this trend we've been in for decades. It's not so much about treatment, but prevention in your eyes.
I think that's right. Once somebody has developed an addiction, our treatments are imperfect and not often successful. So even in the best of hands, maybe 20-30% of people who haven't developed an addiction can get into long-term recovery. So this is a chronic disease. There is no cure. Once you've got it, you've got it. There's no cure. There are treatments, and there are things that can keep it at bay. But once you, we're all born with a cucumber. Once you make your brain a pickle, it can't go back to being a cucumber again. So ultimately, the way to address this epidemic is through prevention. The analogy that I use is a river, and in the river there are children drowning, and you are walking by and you jump in the river and you try to rescue these kids and pull them to shore, but there are just too many of them and you can't save them all, unfortunately. Another person comes by and yells to the other person, "Come on in and help me save all these children, they're drowning." And the other person says, "No, you keep doing that. I'm going to go upstream and find out why they're falling in the river in the first place." And that's what we need to do with this opioid epidemic, is to look upstream and find out how are people getting addicted in the first place and preventing that from happening. So I talked about the five things that contributed to the epidemic, so we need to do at least five things to undo it. Number one, we need to rein in the pharmaceutical companies who are heavily promoting these drugs as being safe and effective. And perhaps we need to ask them or require them to pay up to sort of fix some of the mess that they've helped to make. You know, Purdue made $1 billion a day pushing OxyContin, and that enriched the company's executives, the Sacklers, to a large degree. And maybe they should give back some of that money and help fix the mess. Number two, pharmacies are in a position to be able to flag patients as to who's becoming addicted and who's overprescribing and so forth. And so perhaps they could be a little more proactive. I know there is one pharmacy here that will not fill a prescription for more than 7 days on a new prescription. Patients need to be educated that, you know, it is not possible for the medical community to relieve all pain for all people all the time. And a little, some pain is going to be expected following surgery, wisdom teeth, or whatever. Doctors certainly need to prescribe more wisely. And the Center for Disease Control has come out with guidelines for wise prescribing, and doctors need to be educated about what those guidelines are and required to follow them. Finally, health insurance companies process all the data. They know who the patients are. They know who's buying the drugs. They know which pharmacies are overstocking them. They have those kind of data, and they could be powerful using that those data that they have. They could be a powerful force in helping to reduce this epidemic. So those are some of the things, in a broad way, those are some of the things that we need to do. But we are not going to be able to treat our way out of this epidemic. We're not going to be able to arrest our way out of this epidemic. And we're not going to be able to successfully treat the people who were inadvertently prescribed into addiction. So we really need to prevent them from becoming addicted in the first place.
Twelve Voices in 12 Hours continues. Dr. Richard Blondell is joining us live in studio. You know, opioids, maybe not a serious addiction. Maybe we're not talking about heroin yet, but just opioid, whether it's a prescription or maybe something that's just kind of floating around a group of friends, something kids are going to have to deal with probably at one point or another in their lives growing up when they reach a certain age. I'm going to guess there's maybe not a lot of 13-year-olds listening to us right now, but their parents are. Well, what are some of the things they can do to help their kids?
Parents can play a very important role in helping to immunize their children against falling prey for these drugs. The first thing that I think parents can do is to look at their own family. If there's a family history of alcoholism or drug addiction, and it runs in the family, particularly if one of the child's parents had an alcohol or drug problem at one time, that child is at a particular increased risk. So there are some things they can do. One is to educate your child about the family history. You say, you know, Uncle Freddie had an alcohol problem, and Aunt Tilly had a pill problem, and your father, you know, had a little drinking problem when he was younger, and he got that taken care of. So therefore, you, my child, are at an increased risk just by your genetics. So you can't necessarily do what all of your peers do because they may not have that genetic risk. The way I explain it is if there's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, fair-skinned girl and she's going to go on spring break with all of her Sicilian origin friends or African-American friends and they're all going to go to Florida together and hang out on the beach, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl needs to wear sunscreen because she's not going to be able to take the same sun that the other kids are. So an analogy to that is somebody who has a family history of drug or alcohol problems is like the blonde-haired, blue-haired kid. And the rather than sun exposure, it's exposure to drugs or alcohol. It's not going to have the same effect. So you need to tell your child about the increased risk. Here's what we know. And we also need to know to have them delay the onset of using any of these drugs. So we know, for example, that if a child has their first drink, a drink, before the age of 14, as an adult, they got a 50-50 chance of becoming an alcoholic. If that person waits to 21 to have their very first drink, the risk of alcoholism is 5 to 10%. We know this. So there's a couple of things there delaying the onset. I also mentioned that even just one prescription for an opioid will increase the risk of subsequent addiction by 33% as an adult. So when your child is given a prescription for an opioid, you have to really ask, is this worth it? Is the pain really that bad? The other thing is that if you do have medications around the house and your child is overprescribed, so let's just say they get 30 or 60 pills for a wisdom tooth and the kid takes two, you got to get rid of the rest of them. Either take them to the pharmacy in a give back thing or a drug day, or put a little Clorox in the bottle, dissolve the pills, double bag it, throw it out in the trash. Really, some people say flush it down the toilet, but then all these pharmaceuticals end up in our water supply, and that's really not a good idea either. So those are some of the things you can do. If, as an individual, now, if you have a family history of a drug or alcohol problems, you have to be very careful about if the doctor gives you or the dentist gives you these prescriptions and recognize that you have this risk. So then you only take them if you really, really need them, and then get rid of the surplus. And tell somebody else about that, because sometimes what happens is that somebody gets these pills and they think, I'll just save them for a rainy day and I might be spraying my ankle again and I'll just keep them in the medicine cabinet. And then sometimes people just have a bad day and they end up taking one. And that's how it starts.
And one can start it.
And one can start it.
12 Voices in 12 Hours continuing. We've talked about a lot of things. Want to kind of cycle back to something we talked about at the very beginning. Getting a lot of comments here about addiction, about opioid medications, the way they are prescribed, and some pushback on some things you said earlier, that this is what works, that if you're in real pain, you need this medication. What is your response to the people who push back and say, this is the medication I need?
Well, that's true. For people who have severe acute pain, there's nothing that works better than opioids for acute pain short term. So post-operative pain, for example, broken bones, they work very well as long as people take them as long as they have pain and don't continue to take them once the pain goes away, which is the problem. So about 10% of the people, most of the people, when the pain goes away, they stop taking the pills. About 10% of the people, pain goes away, they're still taking the pills. So that's the issue. Now, for chronic pain, opioids, not so good. So they have some role in the treatment of chronic pain, but they're not the be-all to end-all. So there are other things that we need to do to treat chronic pain, so not just to rely on opioids. For people with chronic pain, so I talked about acute pain, maybe 5 to 10% of the people, that will trigger an addiction. For chronic pain, we know that long-term use of opioids, like over 24 weeks, may trigger addiction somewhere between 25 to 50% of people, which means that about half the people can take opioids over the long haul and do okay with that. And so you may get pushback from people, well, I'm on these medicines, I don't have any bad effects, and they're good for me. That's fine. But just because it works that way in one person doesn't mean it's going to work that way in everybody. And I'm here to tell you, in my practice, I see a lot of patients who were prescribed opiates and develop a problem. Not right away. So usually these people are taking opiates from like three to five years before the wheels come off and then there's a problem. So once somebody's been on opioids for chronic pain for 3 to 4 years and they become addicted, I can tell you that is one difficult a patient treatment problem. And reversing that is not easy at all. So just because one or two people say it works for me, that does not necessarily mean that it applies to every person on the planet. So every patient is different. And what's different about them is their genetics. We know, for example, that there's a gene that changes how the opioid receptor works to make the drug bind more tightly to that receptor. And those people are at risk for an addiction. We also know that there are families that don't make enough of their own natural painkillers, the endorphins, and those people are at risk for addiction. So in the future, once we've got more of this stuff figured out, what the genes are, where they are, and what they do, we may be actually do a blood test and give somebody the odds of developing addiction. Wouldn't that be great before people start pain management to know what their odds are of addiction?
When a baby's born, then they could take this blood test and they would know.
They take a little sample of the blood from the umbilical cord, run this up, and tell the parents, your child's at risk for this, this, and this disease. Now, we have the ability to do some of that now, and we do some of that genetic testing for like PKU or sickle cell disease. So we're going to go into these ethical issues as to how much we're going to do that and what people are going to do with the information. Do they want to know the information? Mm-hmm. So we know that, for instance, Huntington's chorea, the disease that killed Woody Guthrie, we know that we can tell who's going to develop this disease. So does the average 17-year-old want to know that? Are they going to have this fatal disease or not? So these are some of the other social things that we haven't kind of worked through. But the science will get us there. And we have to be prepared as to, you know, how are we going to handle this information? What are we going to do with it?
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly!